Welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and to those all over the world, apparently, accessing the show on the internet. It's the election next month, as you might have noticed, so we have UKIP MEP for the South West, Trevor Coleman, in the studio, telephone link-up with Charlotte Leslie, the Conservative candidate for Bristol North West, and Anton Debreu, who was for many years a leading media consultant and broadcasting conference organiser, and is now working on a major book which looks at cyclical patterns in recent history. Our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Greaves reads the last instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Castle, our resident bard, reads his latest poem, and Jeff Sparks, as ever, is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. Well, I'm John Peters Common, and it's my pleasure to introduce guest Anton Debreu. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. So tell me a little bit, without dwelling too much on your background, and what have you been doing with your career so far?
Well, I've been a media consultant for a long time, but I gave that up and turned to writing a book on recent history. And that has involved looking at recent crises, things that have developed over the last 150 years.
Okay.
And yes, I'm interested in the election like everyone else, been deluged with radio about it, but I do happen to think it's a very important threshold, this election.
Okay. Why do you think it's particularly significant in this case?
Well, I think a lot of things have come around. I mean, obviously, most people would point to the credit crunch and all the financial fallout that's happened from that as a key indicator. But I think there's a sense when you look at what's happened historically over the last 15 or even 30 years that we've got to a stage where people are questioning some of the fundamental ways in which people have run society. Whether that actually manifests in a change in government is open to question. But I think people are thinking more beyond the tactical. They're thinking about a new approach to things.
Okay. I mean, tell me a little bit. I mean, you're interested in the nature of cyclical history. I mean, do you feel that there are issues here which are repetitious from what has happened over the past sort of...
Yes, Afghanistan, for one.
Yes.
The British and French governments back in the 1920s carved out most of the Middle East. And if you look at all the crises that are going on in the world today, a lot of them can be dated back, at least partly, to that period when countries were divided up. Mm-hmm. So I think we're coping with that. But I mean, other things, much more recently, is financial. I mean, we've had this massive collapse of the banking system. You only need to look back not so long ago to something that was called Big Bang, which under the Conservatives initiated a total deregulation of the financial sector. Okay. So I would say there's a definite link between, in a cyclical sense, between the two.
Okay, I mean, your experience is, you know, you advised a lot of broadcasting companies on business development, I mean, particularly in the media. Do you think that deregulation was generally a good thing, or do you think it was a bad thing?
Deregulation broadcasting? That's a difficult one, yes. I mean, I think it's given people more choice, but that's all I'd say.
Do you like the idea of choice? Because Labour are very pro-choice. You always can choose everything.
Choice is fine. It's an easy word. I don't think that's a controversial word. Competition is the word. I know we're going to be talking about the EU shortly. And there are several gods erected in Brussels. And one of them is to the god of competition, in that whatever is done has to accord to that. Is it improving competition or is it not? Now, that's been accepted by people in government as an unquestioned principle. And I think, you know, I'd be interested to see what...
Okay, well, what role do you think national sovereignty has in how competition takes place in a country? I mean, we've given up some of our sovereignty to Brussels. Do you think that's a good thing for business development, or do you think that's a bad thing?
I think it's mixed. I mean, yes, in a trade sense, I'm sure there have been some advantages. It's more the choking bureaucracy that's accompanied it that I'd pick up on.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about that then. I mean, do you believe that this top-down idea of Brussels government works? or could be made to work if it doesn't at the moment?
It ought to work, but it doesn't, I think, is the answer.
It doesn't, okay. I mean, we're going to chat to Trevor Coleman in a moment. We've heard your perspective as a sort of a business development man come Simon Sharma, and your perspective. Do you like UKIP on the whole?
I think UKIP is a very interesting party, yes.
Interesting, okay. Do you generally agree with their policy? Do you think we should pull out of the EU?
I think it's something that should be considered.
Something that should be considered,
or,
okay.
Or renegotiating it, yes.
Renegotiating, okay.
But well, I can't say it's a central belief that I hold, but I think it's certainly something worth considering.
Okay, well, we've only touched on a few opening subjects there, but I'd like to come back to you later on and welcome Trevor Coleman. Hello.
Hello, and good evening.
Okay, so how long have you been a member of UKIP?
Since 1999.
Okay, and what did you do before that?
I did a few things. I was in the police force for 33 years. And then I began to do a bit of writing and that kind of work, and I worked in TV for about 6 years. Looking forward to getting my golf handicap down to single figures.
Right.
And then I made the mistake of going to a political meeting, and that virtually changed my life and ruined my golf handicap. And I've been with UKIP ever since that time.
Okay, so what was it particularly about UKIP as opposed to the Conservatives that really drew you in?
Well, it wasn't really the party itself, it was what it stood for. And I realised when I'd gone to this meeting that something dreadfully wrong had taken place in this country way back in the early 70s. And from then on, I was trying to be involved in the fight to restore what we'd lost at that time.
Okay, so I mean, I guess there are two reasons people disagree. There's the things the way they are and what fears people have for the future and what the EU means in that respect. So with the Lisbon Treaty in 2007, I mean, do you think the European Parliament extended its powers as far as possible? Are we sort of there now? Is it just a matter of refining what we've got?
Firstly, yes. The Lisbon Treaty was the linchpin that topped out, if you like, the other five treaties. And it handed over to the European Union almost complete control of this country, apart, of course, from our finances. We've hung on to the pound sterling, which is a good thing too, mm-hmm. With what is happening abroad at the moment. But that's a side issue, really. What you've seen over the last 35 years is a gradual transference of power from Westminster to Brussels without consulting the people of this country as to whether they want that or not.
Okay, I mean, would you sort of differentiate between sovereignty and actual power as such?
There isn't any. If you're a sovereign nation, you have the right and the power to govern yourself. In other words, to elect the people who make your laws, mm-hmm. and if you want to get rid of them. That doesn't apply in the European Union.
Okay, that's interesting.
The lawmakers in the European Union are the people in the EU Commission. They are appointed. They're not elected. They meet in secret. They're not accountable to anyone. And we can't get rid of them. That is not democracy.
Okay, and this is very much a top-down thing. So do you think that a bottom-up sort of response will come around? Do you think people will begin to see that this is a good thing?
I hope so, because at the end of the day, it's the people that will do this. I belong to a political party, but not because I want to form a political party or because I want to be a politician. I belong to this party to give an opportunity for the people of this country to express their will. They've not had that opportunity over the last 35 years. If they don't want to express that will, that's entirely up to them. But at least they've got the opportunity.
Okay. What do you think about the possibility of a referendum? Because Gordon Brown had famously, you know, sort of five golden rules, a bit stretched out forever. Do you think you support the idea? Do you support the idea of a referendum?
Of course I do. Yeah. I've already said that I believe it's the people who will decide.
Yeah.
This.
Okay. And do you think that is likely?
With the other three parties, mm-hmm. there is no likelihood of that. Okay. None whatsoever.
I mean, the UK is sort of a net contributor to the EU. We put in more than we get out, and. Do you think that is, you know, if that were to change, if we got more out of it, would you change your mind?
Not a bit. The price we pay to belong to this is we have lost the right to govern ourselves. Whatever the advantages are, and I can't see any, to be quite honest, but if whatever the advantages are, they are not big enough to compensate for the loss of the ability to govern yourself. If you haven't got that ability, you're not free.
Okay,
I mean, you're no longer a sovereign nation.
But surely we must recognise interdependence between nations. This was the EU was a post-Second World War child. I mean, it keeps the peace, doesn't it? If we all put our eggs in one basket, it kind of stops us invading each other and territorial disputes. Doesn't it keep the peace?
Well, first of all, if you look around the world, you will see that other nations don't need to do this. Secondly, we didn't join until about 30 years after the Second World War, so it doesn't look as though our involvement is really that important as far as peace is concerned. And thirdly, the price is too much to pay. I've said that. But you must ask the people. At the end of the day, as long as the people are asked, I don't mind.
Okay, and possibly an obvious question, but do you believe the work of the European Parliament is of considerable significance for the life of everyday EU citizens, such as ourselves and here?
The simple answer is no. MEPs have got no power. We can't make laws. We can't raise taxes. We are there to give the illusion of democracy, that's all.
Okay. Well, I'd like to bring Anton back into the conversation at this point. Hello.
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 Yeah, so I have a question for Trevor. I mean, I recognise the source of most of the concerns that drive his wish for us to get out of the EU. But on the other hand, it seems to me we live in an era where everything is coming together. We live in an era in particular where China and the USA are, and India are, mammoth trading entities. It seems to me that we should have some sort of EU. Isn't there an EU, a new sort of EU, Trevor, that you might consider acceptable? One with considerably less bureaucracy and perhaps diminished scope?
I know precisely what you're talking about, Anton, and I can see what you're driving at. We were told back in the early 70s by Ted Heath that by joining the common market, as it was then called, that we were joining a trading agreement. And it was upon that thesis that we actually took the referendum in 1975. We voted on a trading agreement. We were told specifically there was no loss of sovereignty, and yet we were lied to. So the point you're making is absolutely right. Of course we can carry on trading with the EU, perhaps on special terms, I don't know. But look at what has happened to Norway and what has happened to Switzerland. They're not in the European Union, and they're the richest nations in Europe. So yes, of course there will be agreements and there'll be trade agreements, but we just don't want to be governed by people who don't live in this country and are from this country.
But what I meant, sort of, I can see that an economic grouping with much weaker control would be acceptable to you. But what about, and we now have an EU member, an EU representative who goes around the world saying, I speak on foreign crises for the EU. Do you think there is a role for the EU to be politically, diplomatically, even militarily a force in the world?
I mean, particularly at this point, because the CIA did a report that predicted that by 2025 it was possible the EU would be what they termed a soft superpower, insofar as economically as a bloc we would be the biggest power. And so therefore, even though we don't have an united army or military force, we could be of, we could be a great power in the world on a par with the US and China. I mean, would that not be a good thing? Because we'd be a part of that.
There's a simple answer to this question. Mm-hmm. Ask the people. Tell the people what this entails. Tell them what the advantages and disadvantages are. And then ask them if this is what they want. And if this is what they want, I'll go along with that. It's as simple as that. Ask the people. And I think you'll find out that the people will say no.
Okay. Anton, what would you say?
I just say it's a very complicated topic. Looking at the Treaty of Lisbon, I'm quite honestly, which of us could possibly make an instant decision on its remarkably complicated document? I don't know. If you ask people whether they wanted an economic grouping that would give them some advantage, yes, I can see they'd sign on to that. If you ask them whether they should be part of a group that plays a diplomatic role, difficult question for people to answer, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, Trevor, I mean, were there to be a referendum, people said yes on the whole, for example, immigrants as a net contribute to the UK more than they take out. I mean, would UKIP say, well, okay, then people have spoken and, we'll just pack up shop and go home?
No. We have a raft of policies, as you know, which have been announced this very week. Mm-hmm. And those policies set out the way we see our society evolving in this country. But none of these things can happen unless we have the ability to govern ourselves. Look, Anton said earlier on that this was a tipping point. He's absolutely right. The forthcoming election is both pointless and very, very important. It's pointless because whoever goes into number 10, Juan Barroso, will still govern this country. Mm-hmm. He's the president of the EU Commission. And it's very, very important because we have reached a tipping point in the control and governance by the European Union.
Well, Trevor Coleman and Anton Dubrow, thank you very much for both coming in, but stay where you are because we're going to ring Charlotte Leslie now, the Conservative candidate for Bristol North West. And hopefully we'll pick up the phone and we'll be able to further this discussion.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, I'd like to introduce to the line now Charlotte Leslie, the Conservative candidate for Bristol North West. Hello.
Hello, good to talk to you.
Hi. So, how well do you think you're going to do defeating Doug Naismith? Because he's currently sat in the seat and is quite popular.
It's going to be a really, really tight election. There's no doubt about it. And that's both nationally and locally here in Bristol North West, which is where I'm standing.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Bristol North West and the exciting thing for voters is that this is one of the seats that could change the government. So that means it's a seat that the Conservatives, we have to win to change government, and it's a seat that Labour will be looking to hold on to keep Gordon Brown in number 10. So the race is on, and it promises to be a very close one.
Right, OK. I mean, that will be certainly a bit of a first, because Bristol has always been a bit of a left-wing sort of Labour-Liberal stronghold.
Well, again, I mean, we've had a Conservative MP here. We lost it in 1992. It's my seat, Bristol North West, is a combination of two existing seats, Bristol West and the old Bristol North West.
I see.
And
okay.
Both those seats have been Conservative seats, and they're very much what the pundits and the experts call sort of weather vane seats.
Okay, I mean,
so it's seats that tend to dictate or to reflect the change of government.
Right. I mean, we've been discussing the EU quite heavily in the studio today. I mean, where do you stand on? Are you generally pro-EU, as with sort of Ken Clark? Would you say you're more generally anti-EU in your stance?
Oh, I'm very much pro-Britain playing an appropriate role in the EU. Now, I'm not someone who says Britain should be out of the EU altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, I think our involvement in the EU has gone far too far. I mean, I'm pro the EU because we have free trade barriers, and in a world of globalisation, we need to tackle things like climate change globally together. We need to tackle the international terrorism threats globally together, and for that, Europe is invaluable.
Okay, I mean,
there's no reason why we should be so tied up in the social legislation that Europe imposes on us. And there's an awful lot, I think, that needs to change in Europe to make sure that Britain's at the heart of Europe, driving Europe forward, as opposed to, as many people feel, and I feel, really very much held back by Europe and dictated to by Europe, and the British people losing their sense of sovereignty over our own country.
Right. I mean, the Tory party infamously are quite heavily sort of split on the EU issue, and they seem to have been very well behaved in the run-up to the election. How do you think they're going to fare if they get into power? How long do you think they'll last before tensions inevitably begin to rise again?
Well, to be honest, I mean, having sort of being part of the Conservative Party, there aren't really any tensions on the EU at all, because, to be honest, the situation we're facing here at home is fairly drastic. I mean, if you look at the fact that we've got the highest budget deficit we've had since the Second World War, and that's not after we've had several years settling another country, that's after several years of some of the most wealthy boom times, you know, Europe has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
That is the top priority, I think, for any government of Great Britain that doesn't want to see Great Britain become the next Greece.
I mean, the Tories are saying that cuts are inevitable, but surely cuts to government expenditure is going to make the economic situation even worse.
I mean, obviously, reining in what has been completely irresponsible public spending is an absolute priority. And I think this government has forgotten that public spending and the spending of government money is not government money, it's actually our money. It's the hard-earned money of every single citizen and working citizen of this country.
Mm.
There is so much waste that has happened. My dad works in the NHS, and he has seen firsthand that so much investment has gone into the NHS, but it's not always gone. Well, it's really not gone to the frontline services.
Okay.
And gone straight to patient care. It's gone to things like management, administration, bureaucracy, targets, meeting targets, meetings.
I'll stop you there a little bit. I mean, just on a more local front, I mean, what's your background? Do you come from Bristol?
Yeah, I've lived in Bristol for 28, 29 years, and I've seen a lot of changes. I mean, I remember when the Mall was just Carrefour, and the rest was Greenfields.
Yeah.
And I learned to swim in the old Henbury School pool, which many of your listeners will know was around quite a little while ago, so
okay.
Showed my age a bit.
I mean, in the studio at the moment, I actually have I've got a UKIP MEP for the South West, Trevor Coleman,
mm-hmm.
who's been sort of listening in. Trevor, I mean, have you got any points that you'd like to raise in response to what she said?
Yes, good evening. I'd like to ask you, is there any point where a Conservative government would take Britain out of the European Union?
Well, at the moment, I mean, there's some very valuable things about the European Union, as I discussed. And I know often Norway is cited as an example of, you know, the benefits of just leaving the EU. But what's not often said is that the price that Norway pays to still enjoy the same kind of trading that we enjoy within the EU, the free trading barriers, is about £1 billion. Now, if we used if we transferred Norway's level of economic activity and trade to Britain's level of economic trade, it would actually cost us more to trade with Europe equally to be out of the EU than it actually does to be within the EU. And I think that's a very important point that needs to be made. Now, I completely appreciate all the arguments to say that all the ridiculous social laws that govern this country and take away the sovereignty of this country from the British people are superfluous and they must be done away with, which is why David Cameron is so committed to a proper sovereignty bill, which incidentally Germany brought in just before they signed the Lisbon Treaty. But, and it's a disgrace we didn't do anything like that.
Is the Tory...
To be outside the EU is not an advantageous position. We need to dictate where we need to be in the EU, not be dictated by Europe.
Okay, given that you said that you won't take us out of the European Union, how can you possibly bargain and negotiate with the European Union to improve our standing, because you've got nothing to bargain with? There is no national veto anymore now, and in order to bring about any significant change, we would need unanimity with the other 26 nations. So making the kind of promises you've made, with all due respect, just can't happen.
With all due respect, I mean, if you look at the balance of Europe, we are an extremely valuable player for Europe. This country, let's not forget, it's a small island, but my goodness, do we hold a very valuable and extremely prestigious place on the world stage. Now, Europe needs us, I would posit, as much, if not more, than we need them.
Europe certainly needs us.
We are able to start negotiating on what we give to Europe and the stakes we give to Europe, our relations with America, so we have everything to play for.
Europe certainly needs us because we actually buy more from them than they buy from us. We're also a net contributor to the European Union, but we've lost our sovereignty. Your particular party has been very responsible in handing over to Brussels the governance of this nation away from Westminster. So we shall bear that in mind in the forthcoming election.
OK, I'll cut in there, Trevor, because we're running out of time. But just lastly, on the issue of the EU, I mean, Charlotte, is a referendum likely if the Tories come to power on the issue of the EU?
Well, what we have committed to doing is to making sure that the disgrace of what happened in signing over Britain's sovereignty in the Lisbon Treaty never, ever happens again.
But it's already happened.
Well, that unfortunately, if we'd been in power, that would not have happened.
Okay,
if
but are you going to have a referendum?
Referendum that all three parties promised, and we would have given them that referendum. We are going to put through Parliament a bill that states that no more sovereignty can be taken away from the United Kingdom, from Great Britain.
Okay, I'll stop you there, Trevor.
Without a full referendum of the British people.
That's a totally worthless gesture to make, because you know better than anyone that the Lisbon Treaty contains the passerelle clause, which gives the European Union the right to do virtually anything it likes. It's what is known as a self-amending clause. They don't need any more treaties. This is the final one. This is the one that Mr. Cameron should have kept his promise on, and he didn't.
Briefly?
I have to say, I mean, I think your constituent should do his research a bit more, and there is certainly a lot of ground we can take, and we can pass that bill, and we have pledged to do so.
Okay, well, Charlotte Leslie, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us this evening, and best of luck.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, after that very intense session there, our next track, a nice musical interlude, is by Antonio Banderas, who famously starred in Zorro and was also the cat in Shrek. This is from a musical album of his, and here's his version of Imagine.
If you try, no hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people breathing for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with David, who is an Israeli student, talking about Israel and the conflict with Palestine.
David,
can you tell us about Israel?
About Israel? What exactly do you want to know? Israel contains so much madness.
In what way?
If you go back to the roots of Israel, I think it starts with madness. It starts with irrational behavior of people.
Is this the British you're talking about dividing?
Well, of course, the British were there, and then you get a crazy situation in Israel, which is very blurry, and some of it relies on religions, which is funny, because in Israel, non-religious people, when you speak about the situation with the Arab people, they go to the religion, but they are not religious at all. So we have no resources to decide who owns the land or who owned the land or who took over the land and who forced himself. But eventually what we know happened clearly, that the British were there, and then what we get? We get Arab people with donkeys sitting on the beach, living their life modestly with the land, respectable, and in a very traditional way. And we have Israeli people who wanted to build Israel and who were traumatized at the same time by the Holocaust. And then you get Hebrew people, Israeli people, who were very intelligent at the moment and who could apply to the British consul, to the British authorities, in order to get the land. But does it make any sense? You know, does it make any sense? Arab people who deal with donkeys and building tents and living with a very basic kind of life, and you get Israeli people who came from Europe and who were used to different standards and who eventually discussed with the British people over the land, ignoring the fact that our people were there. But then again, who knows? You know, Israeli people were there and Arab people were there, and it gets messy. I can't explain it, and I think whoever think he can explain it is ignoring some of the facts for sure.
So were you born in Israel?
Yeah.
And where did your parents come from?
Well, there you get a nice blend. My father is half Romanian and half Polish, and most of my family on this side was killed in the Holocaust. And then you get the other side of the family. My mother was born in Morocco. And so I'm a mixture of such different cultures.
So you're a mixture of Arab and Israeli.
Oh, there you go. You get into a nice point because, you know, Israeli people, we have a lot of Moroccan people. And Moroccan people came to Israel. And we live as if Moroccan people are not Arab people, which is ridiculous.
Are you talking about Moroccan Arab or Moroccan Berber?
I'm talking about Moroccan Jewish people.
Oh.
But even though they're Moroccan Jewish people, Moroccan is Arab, is Arabic. Moroccan language is pretty similar to Arabic. But people, again, choose to ignore stuff in order to divide the society. No, no, no. We have Jewish people, we have Christian people, we have Muslim people, we have Israeli, we have Arab, we have this, we have that. All in order to create a separation and to, you know, to be governed.
Does it work?
How many lives have been taken already? How the soil in Israel is so saturated with blood that it's unbelievable, and we keep doing stuff which are not rational. And who can explain this situation, this crazy situation that the mother is happy to give her son to the army, to the military, and she knows and she prepares herself, you know, in some kind of way that he might die there. And this preparation for his death is pure craziness. And on the other side, you have Arab people, which basically do the same. The family encouraged the Arab guy to be a shahid, to commit suicide in order to kill a lot of people. But we refer to it as craziness. But why is it crazy? It's the same. We send our sons to the war to die, and we keep on being proud of it. What is it to be proud of? Doesn't it make sense to live, to want people to live? And does it make any sense to illude yourself, to think that you can solve a situation of hate with another hate?
What do you think about the wall?
The what?
The Gaza and the wall.
The wall. It's, you know, it's funny because when I was a young boy, my parents read to me, it's just a children's story. And it reminds me it every time, because what is it? What's going on in the world? Why do people build a wall?
To keep people in or to keep people out?
Exactly. But if I want to live my life, yes, and I want people to be out of my life, that means that I want to keep myself in a bubble. Do I want to... Who's benefiting here? I live in a bubble, which makes no sense. And I keep people out of the bubble. And if I don't care about them, in some way I don't care about myself as well. Why? Because if they will be frustrated and they want to come in, today it's a 1 meter tall, it's a 1 meter high. And tomorrow they will bring a ladder, it's 2 meters high. And tomorrow they will fly with balloons to the sky and it's 5 meter high. Eventually I will reach the moon. But still the problem is not solved. Because I have fear in my heart and I have no compassion, and the other side is suffering or not suffering, but there is no communication. So it's ridiculous.
Have you ever been to Gaza?
Never, unfortunately. Never. It's because I think that if I go there, I cannot face the situation, because it will force me to take a side. And I don't have a side. I don't want to tell them how I think that Israeli people are stupid. And I don't want to shout in their face that I think the Arabic people are stupid. I think we all are stupid. And if one person cannot face his stupidity, then he shouldn't speak about other people's stupidity. And if I'm not ashamed of the fact that I've never been in Gaza and never brought, you know, peace between me and people in Gaza, if I had no shame about it, I would never speak about other people. And so it's not a problem. It's not enough to be ashamed of those things. But I think we should take an action. And it's not smart to do something, and this is what happened, unfortunately, in the world, that people goes ahead of their time and they try to reach a certain point without appropriate preparation.
Thank you very much to Anthony Page, and not least to David, of course, for allowing himself to be interviewed for that feature. Well, courtesy of our very own Tony Gosling, this week's feature from him is Michael McColgan, who's a human rights lawyer from Sheffield. In this feature, he discusses bad terror laws and ASBOs and a potential solution to them in the National Union of Journalism's guide, Journalist's Guide to Reporting Terrorism.
In these ASBO proceedings, the court can take hearsay evidence. What we get, and I've done several of these, is a policeman will come in and the prosecutor will sort of say, well, what's your evidence? And he will say, blah, 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 blah. And then a lady further down the road, I don't want to give the number because she's afraid to come to court and she's afraid of recriminations. She says that these boys have been banging on her window, smashing her garden gate, doing this, that and the other, letting a firework in her kitchen, so forth and so on. Right. Then they read a statement from somebody, unidentified, anonymous, and the judges, to a man and a woman, are allowing this hearsay evidence in. Hearsay, it's double hearsay, it's third hand, it's fourth hand, or whatever. Now, that 20 years ago would have been unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable. But it's a bit like the right of silence. You remember the right of silence? When the Conservative government made its first moves to outlaw that? Douglas Hurd, Home Secretary at the time, said this is only going to apply in terrorist cases. Yeah, what's the position now? The right of silence is effectively abolished in ordinary burglary, shoplifting cases, because there's a Section 34 of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act where the judge can tell the jury, if he said nothing in the police station and now says something in court, absolutely, you can draw adverse inferences from it. So in other words, the right of silence, it started off as an exceptional measure, the abolition of it, and it's now become the norm. And what I'm afraid of is that this secret evidence, of which SEAC is the embodiment, is filtering through into all kinds of other organisations and all kinds of other systems. For instance, there are the, as I said, the antisocial behaviour orders. There are the Freedom of Information Act, the Investigating Powers Tribunal, and so forth and so on. There are any number of tribunals and courts now where that kind of laxity about the standard of proof and about the directness of the evidence is allowed in. And I think what this is doing is watering down the system of justice in this country to an awful degree. I just want to stop there because I don't want to take up too much of your time. But what I would say in conclusion is that Naeem mentioned the press response, or the Gordon Brown saying we've uncovered a major terrorist plot. Mm-hmm. Of course, Gordon Brown saying that wouldn't have reached anybody had it not been transmitted to them by the journalists. they were the ones who wrote the story up. They were the ones who did the front page headlines. They were the ones who broadcast it on Look North or Granada TV or the rest of it. And I'm very glad that this initiative has been taken, because it seems to me it is important. And I think that I don't want to cast aspersions. It's not for me to sort of moralise about this. But I think there has been a tendency amongst journalists over the years to take for granted what has been told to them by government spokesmen. Reporters, local reporters, and they're the worst. I mean, my local paper, the Sheffield Star, and they can report that if they like, the Sheffield Star is the most blatantly line-towing, timid sort of people. You've only got to get a policeman outside court saying this. And of course, you see it on television now. Someone gets convicted. Who's the spokesman for society? Chief Inspector so-and-so says this was a most heinous crime for which the punishment hardly is sufficient, blah, 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 blah. And everybody thinks, yes, the God has spoken. And it really is that kind of thing. And what I think the press needs to do, and this is why this leaflet is so timely, is it needs to stop people, and when they're writing a story, not say just because Gordon Brown says it's a big terrorist plot, to look into it and ask whether. I mean, the inverted commas have almost gone, yeah? They have gone, in fact, da-da-da-da-da at the bottom, court told, yeah? What do you see? If you're the average reader, you don't see that. You see, man attacks so-and-so with hammer, court told, yeah? And I remember Lord Justice Sedley, there's a point there where he says, we can never know until the end of a trial how it's going to turn out. And of course, what happens in a trial, a major trial, like a murder trial, all the headlines are on the prosecution case. When it comes to the defence case, the reporters say, not particularly interested in that. When the acquittal comes, nothing. Yeah, and that is a responsibility of primarily of editors, I think, editors and proprietors. But I think it's also up to the journalists themselves to make sure that they put both sides of it. Just as you need to hear both sides in the courtroom, so you need to see both sides in the newspaper report. And that's why I very much welcome this initiative which you're doing today. I think my accusations would apply more to the younger reporters.
Thank you very much to Michael McColgan, human rights lawyer from Sheffield there, not least to Tony Gosling for doing it, for their report. And if you want to find out more about the Guide to Reporting Terrorism, you can visit the National Union of Journalists website, nuj.org.uk, and you'll find information about the guide on their website. Well, the end of an era, possibly, for those of you eagle-eared listeners who have been paying attention to Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village, for this is the very last episode. Courtesy of Malcolm Greaves, straight out of Swindon, his honeyed tones here read the words of A.G. Street.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Not exactly idle thoughts. Modern newspapers are wonderful things, but of late, they are getting beyond me. Possibly I am a trifle slow in the uptake, or perhaps I am not sufficiently gullible. Anyway, I cannot swallow all that I read in them nowadays. On one page, I find a thoroughly convincing article, which states that agriculture should be put immediately, if not sooner, on a sound and lasting prosperous basis. Having digested this with some satisfaction, I turn to the next page, to be greeted with large and flaming headlines to the effect that housewives should on no account pay more for their food. That food is cheaper than it has been for years, down to pre-war price almost. And isn't it glorious? A pound now buys 25 shillings worth of food. God's in his heaven, the paper in question has the situation well in hand, and all's right with the country. Not so good, this page, from my point of view. Distinctly not so good. So I turn yet another page and find there an impassioned column which states that to reduce the wages of anybody, especially of the agricultural labour, would be scandalous, un-British, in fact, not cricket. By this time I realise that I am getting into deep waters. So I drop the paper and think about these three pages. And the more I think about them, the more puzzled I become. As far as I can see, the only solution is for the paper to send a prepaid telegram to the celestial regions offering the Archangel Gabriel a handsome retainer to come down to Earth and see about it. For I am convinced that these things cannot be brought about at one and the same time by any human agency. Of course, either two are possible. You can have a prosperous agriculture, decent wages for farm workers, and dearer food. You can have cheap food, a prosperous agriculture, and scandalous wages for farm workers. But of course that will not last very long. Or you can have what you have been having for some years now, cheap food, decent wages for farm workers, and a bankrupt agriculture. Again, not for much longer. You will not agree with this last statement, most probably. You will say, oh, farmers have always grumbled. They've been bankrupt for so long now that they're used to it. Any change, even for the better, would only be another cause for more grumbles. Whatever the price of food, the countryside will always be the same when we go down for our holidays. Farmers have cried wolf once too often. And quite honestly, I think you would be justified. We have cried wolf too often in the past, and now that the wolf is really at our doors, the townsman won't believe it. But when you say that the countryside will always be the same charming place to visit, irrespective of the profit and loss accounts of farming, you are grossly mistaken. Next time you are in North Wiltshire, I hope you will journey to a little village between Marlborough and Swindon, and see for yourselves what can happen to an English village. You will find it a depressing experience. The name of this village is Snape. It has been admirably described by Sir William Beach Thomas in his book Why England Becomes Prairie. After reading his book, and scarce believing what I read, I went to Snape with a brother farmer in 1928 to see for myself. I do not think I have ever spent a more depressing afternoon. Nearing Snape, we inquired the way of a man who was working by the roadside. He was making a catching pen for grass sheep. I will give you his reply verbatim. Snape, you do mean the wild land, I suppose. 'Tis a long thick lane, about a mile. You wouldn't find much of the village left. The church be gone. I used to sing in the choir when I were a boy, and t'other day I helped to pull 'un down. We thanked him and journeyed on to find that it was only too true. We discovered the remains of two large farmhouses and several cottages with their overgrown gardens and orchards. Sheep tracks ran through the ground floor rooms, and over the whole countryside hung the hush of desertion. It gave one the creeps. The impression of hideous desolation was enhanced by the finding of a dead sheep just in front of one of the farmhouses. I disturbed the crows that were pecking out its eyes. I went up there again last Easter Monday and found it all slipped a little further into decay. I do not want to be sentimental about it, but having been a farmer all my life, I could not help standing in front of that large farmhouse ruin and picturing the busy scene there in the early morning some years ago when Snape was a flourishing village. And it is all gone. It seems a tragedy. Here was a little community which has been blotted out. It was raining on Easter Monday while I was there, and a party of youthful hikers were sheltering from the rain in one of the ruins. They were amusing themselves by singing various modern songs, one of which was Just One More Chance. Well, Snape has gone too far. But I think there is today a brief to give our agriculture just one more chance. And if this is to be, the townsman must find the money, either in higher prices for farm products, his food, or in monetary assistance from the Exchequer. While he keeps the cost of production at an uneconomic level, there is no other way, and I think it would be wisest at this juncture in our history to be honest and to admit that the money will, perforce, come from the townsman chiefly. I realise that there are in the country many more people who eat food than there are who produce it. Is it worth their while to invest money in order to make farming a flourishing industry once more? Well, agriculture is the fourth largest industry in the country, both as regards output and labour employed. Textiles and clothing come first, iron and steel second, food, drink and tobacco third, and then farming. Agriculture is the one large industry in this land today which is capable of expansion. In 1925, it produced £225 million in actual sales. This could be greatly increased, thereby reducing our imports and helping our trade balance. You have to remember that the day is gone when England could manufacture for the world. Our customers are now making their own requirements. Where, then, shall we get the money to pay for our imported food? £296 million per annum. More than half this amount could be produced here in addition to our present output. Roughly, it means spending sevenpence here rather than spending sixpence out of the country. In other words, your food will cost you more. But if you do not export manufactured goods, where will you get the money to pay for your imported food? It does not matter how cheap imported food may be, if the day should come when we have not got the money to send out of the country for it, we shall go hungry. However, either on economic grounds or sentimental ones, the townsman does appear to wish to help farming at this juncture. And as a farmer, I wish to say thank you. But I want to point out to him also the importance of knowing on which branches of the industry his money should be spent. With fresh eggs, fresh vegetables, fresh meat, fresh milk and all perishable products, the British farmers and farm labourers can give you a better quality article than anyone in the whole world. With regard to grain, the boot is on the other foot. I'm afraid that I've rambled about a good deal this evening, and that this talk is open to all sorts of criticism, but if I have in some small measure succeeded in pointing out the branches of farming which are of most importance to the nation as consumers, as well as to the farmers as producers, it will have been well worthwhile.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves. I'm sure we'll have more of him reading stuff in the very near future. And that was A.G. Street. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and the Bard of Dialect Radio, is here to give us his latest poem. Hello.
Hello, John.
Well, eagle-eared listeners will have noted that you do like to advertise a good old cabaret now and again. And you had one on Sunday. How did it go?
No, we had one on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, Friday and Saturday, sorry. Yeah, it was, it shows you I pay attention to your advertising, yes. Isn't it?
So okay. It was a wonderful, joyous, exuberant occasion, as ever.
Excellent. So it went very well.
Yeah, it did indeed, yeah.
Okay.
So moving on to politics, of course, the election is excitement is hotting up. So I'm covering the Conservative policy on love this week.
Oh, really? Gosh.
Yes. Did you know that there was a love policy?
No.
Yes, well, it's David Cameron's announced a proposal that would make married couples... up to £3 a week better off.
Good Lord.
Yes, if you can make that commitment, you can get tax advantages. This is part of the...
I'm sure many people will stay together just for that reason.
Part of the new policy, the price of love.
Continue.
Love and marriage. Some people will disparage £3 a week to tie the knot. This reward for love is... not a lot. But Mr. C says take a chance. He's sponsoring long-term romance. True love can be celebrated through tax breaks he has innovated. There will be cuts, there will be pain. All parties peddle this refrain. So don't let your commitment falter. Book your place before the altar. Weddings mean more work for vicars. Act while the flame of love still flickers. Add branches to your family tree through sanctified monogamy. If your wish to wed has been awoken by virtue of this latest token, remember when you say your prayers that money doesn't talk, it swears.
Excellent. That was very much enjoyed. There were lots of quiet sniggering going on in the studio as people attempted to... hide their laughter. Okay, time once again for our very own Jeff Sparks and What's On in Bristol.
Good evening, this is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday 21st of April and the Blue Tones, we'll be performing with support from Married to the Sea at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £13 in advance. On Thursday, 22nd of April, Scarlet's Well would be performing with support from Steve Bush and Fran Fay, and also Back to the Lake at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £3.15 in advance and £5 on the door. Moving into Friday, 23rd of April, The Race will be launching their new album, Welcome Stranger to This Place, at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance, £6 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I feature the legendary Rhythm and Blues Review. This is from the album Command Performance, and is a song titled Whammer Jammer, which is performed by Richard Solwitz, who has inspired many musicians to play the harmonica. The legendary Rhythm and Blues Review with Whammer Jammer from the album Command Performance. For more information, you can check out www.deltagrooveproductions.com. Into Saturday, 24th of April, the All Day Welsh Festival, featuring many groups, for example, Broken Vinyl Club, The Gubbins, Heavy Flames, and Sal, will all be performing at the Prom Bar and also the Blue Lagoon in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 1 p.m. at the Prom Bar, and tickets are £12 for all day and £7 for the evening session. On Sunday, 25th of April, Code Red will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Monday, 26th of April, the Choir Boys will be performing their new album, Halfpenny Dancer, at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Jeff and his Motorhead t-shirt as they go away off into the foggy distance. Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show, so it's time very quickly for me to wrap up. The studio guests that we had were Anton Dubrow, Trevor Coleman, the MEP for the Southwest UKIP party, and we heard the tones of Charlotte Leslie, the Conservative candidate for Bristol North West on the telephone, who did excellently, thank you to her. Malcolm Grieve read the last episode of Hedge Trimmings by AG Street, and we'll read more in the future. Keep your ears open. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and the poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and Dialect Radio, of course. And the What's On was by Jeff Sparks. Studio engineering by Johnny Royd and Andy Gordon, and the producer was Anthea Page. And it's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's Dialect Radio. Oh, and we'd like to say hello to Wendy Greening. Hello. Goodbye.